Fire scientists warn of more megafires as the climate changes. Good evening, I'm Conrad Scheid.
And I'm Corin Cates-Carney, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry tells us about a growing sport in Montana, that's lacrosse. And in our feature story, reporter Edward O'Brien profiles the candidates in the Democratic primary race for the U.S. House. Over 600 wildfire experts from 16 countries are in Missoula this week to examine the changing social, political, and ecological effects of large wildland fires. The experts say years of fire suppression have led to a massive fuel buildup that, combined with climate change, will lead to more so-called megafires. At the same time, more people have moved into the woods, the so-called wildland-urban interface. Dan Bailey is the past president of the International Association of Wildland Fire. He says in the 1960s, about 25 million people lived in the wildland-urban interface. That number has grown to 120 million today.
Of this 120 million people that live in the interface, the U.S. has about 220 million acres, about twice the size of California, that's been designated at high risk of wildland-urban interface fires. So this growing problem continues to face challenges with local communities having to deal with this.
Bob Keene is a Forest Service research ecologist with the Missoula Fire Sciences Lab. He says while most people view large fires as a catastrophe, fire ecologists have a different view.
A lot of ecologists feel that these large fires also present a very unique opportunity in that they actually provide beneficial aspects to a particular ecosystem. In fact, we think that they actually will we can restore ecosystems that have had fire excluded from them from over a century by these large fires. The problem is, of course, is that how do you manage large fires in the context of what society wants and what ecologists would prefer?
The experts agree the so-called megafires will become more and more common. Alan Slapchevich is an Australian fire official who has seen this firsthand.
In the last sort of a decade or decade and a half, we had four seasons in which we had a fire that we would call 1 in 50 or 1 in 100 year events. So four of those in 12 years, something is obviously changing.
He says the average temperature in Australia has risen by 1 degree in the last 30 years and is predicted to rise by another 2 degrees in the next 30 years, making the fire problems even worse. The experts emphasize the public needs to be a lot more involved in dealing with the increased threat of fire. BLM fire behavior analyst Kristen Allison worries if people don't act, more lives will be lost.
My biggest fear is having another year like last year where we lost 34 firefighters in the line of duty.
Ecologist Bob Keene says it does not have to happen. The fire does not always have to be a catastrophe.
But I think it's really tragic that firefighters are losing their lives. I think it's even more tragic that they're losing their lives when that fire could actually have benefited the ecosystem.
Keene says continuing fire suppression is not the right answer to avoiding megafires and to saving lives. The Wildland Fire Conference continues through Friday at the University of Montana.
And in other news from around the state, a Missoula man charged with shooting and killing a German exchange student is scheduled to be arraigned tomorrow morning. Paul Ryan, the attorney for 29-year-old Marcus Karma, says his client arraignment is set for 10:30 a.m. before District Judge Ed McLean in Missoula. Karma is charged with deliberate homicide and the April 27th death of 17-year-old Deiran Didi. Ryan says Karma will plead not guilty. He says he's defending his home after several recent break-ins. Charging documents allege Karma and his girlfriend were frustrated with burglaries and set up motion sensors and cameras in their garage. When they saw someone in the garage, prosecutors say Karma fired 4 shots in the darkened garage, hitting Didi in the head and arm.
3 candidates are vying for a seat on the Missoula County Commission in the Democratic primary. The winner will take on the unopposed Republican candidate Vicki Gordon in the fall. Nicole Rowley is a county environmental health specialist running for her first political office. She says she wants to change the county's reputation of being unfriendly to business. She says the current commission has lost the public's trust.
I've been talking to a lot of different groups of people involved with fairgrounds, the ice sports community, people dealing with the government, with regulations, businesses, people who involved in protecting agricultural land, and of course, victims of sexual assault has been a big topic in Missoula as well. They feel not listened to, and that they've been maybe negotiating with the county for long periods of time or going through a very stagnant processes that they can't move things forward, implementing neighborhood plans that have been approved but then are just sitting there waiting to be implemented, and people feel that they're not involved in the decision-making process, and when decisions are made, things just aren't moving forward. So I think they've lost trust in the ability of the county to serve its constituents.
Incumbent Michelle Landquist is seeking her second term and says it's not true the current commission is not business-friendly.
We've been very business-friendly to a number of businesses that have come in, and we have sponsored a lot of Big Sky Trust Fund grants to help new and existing businesses, and I don't have the long list of businesses that we have helped, but we have helped more businesses get established and expand than we have been unfriendly to. If there's been any unfriendly business practices, it's probably due to problems with state law compliance with DEQ, on Department of Environmental Quality issues.
The county is recently chastised by a district judge for harassing the owners of a local guest ranch the county had sued, and the county lost that suit. Landquist says the county had tried to work things out with the ranch owners before taking them to court. Commissioners have also been criticized for giving County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg $50,000 to sue the Federal Department of Justice, rather than trying to reach an agreement with DOJ over how the county attorney's office handles sexual assault cases. Landquist approved spending the money for the suit until she found out that the state attorney general was working with DOJ on the sexual assault cases.
I would have made a different decision. I would have said no rather than the declaratory judgment. Now is the time to go ahead and lean on the Attorney General, to lean on the DOJ to follow that agreement that they made. I would have never agreed to it had I had that other information. That you have no idea you're requesting all the information on something, you expect to get it, and it was disappointing.
Challenger Nicole Rowley says the county suit against DOJ was a bad decision.
How are you going to fight the Department of Justice with $50,000? And where is this going to stop? And how much money would we keep throwing at it? And if we win the lawsuit, is our county further ahead? Did we win anything? And if we're really not, we're not moving our county ahead, we're not doing anything to help the people who live here, why spend your money on that? I think that $50,000 could have been much better spent on working to improve victim services and working to give training to the people involved from the department, and different things could have been done with the money.
The third candidate in the Democratic County Commission primary race, Donald Davies, did not respond to a request for an interview.
Lacrosse is a common sport from elementary school on up through college on the East Coast. In Montana, it's relatively new, with high school age boys teams and younger growing over the past decade, and girls teams just a couple years old. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more on the growing sport from the recent state tournament in Whitefish.
The complex of sports fields on the southeast edge of Whitefish is packed with kids and teens carrying lacrosse sticks and wearing jerseys from Helena, Bozeman, Billings, Big Sky, the Flathead, and more. Field after field has spectator parents standing on the sidelines, cheering their sons and daughters as they catch, cradle, throw, shoot, score, block, and defend in the state lacrosse tournament. Clarissa Wilkerson is here with her 10- and 12-year-old daughters, Haley and Mackenzie, who play on the Billings girls' team, the Scorpions.
We actually live about 95 miles south of Billings in Fort Smith, Montana. So we drive in for practices and then for games, but it's worth it.
Wilkerson played volleyball, softball, and track, but says she wishes lacrosse was in her area when she was growing up.
Just so much running in the field, exercise that they get is just really great. The ball handling, and it's a nice mix of sports. It's kind of like basketball, field hockey, soccer. It's really good exercise for them, too.
Each team fields 12 players, all carrying lacrosse sticks, about arm-length sticks with a net on the end to catch and throw the ball from, scoop it up off the ground, and shoot on the goal. Scorpion's assistant coach, Anita Foster, says their girls' program is in its second year, and they have 12 girls on the team total.
We are just growing the program in Billings right now, and so we have quite the range. We have a 6-year-old all the way up to a 14-year-old right now on the same team.
Foster is in a position familiar to some of the other girls' teams, sharing players of the right age to field full teams.
So we have worked out a deal with, Missoula will bring some older girls down just to try and equalize it a little bit. They've had to work with us this year because we have such a wide range of girls.
Scorpions! Flathead Boys lacrosse coach Matt Rizzolo is coaching the Valley-wide high school varsity team.
Well, there's 9 high school level teams in the Valley. There's 5 JV teams, and there's a whole bunch of lower level teams across the whole state. We should be expanding to at least 11 teams next year as well. We get about 30, 32 players each year to come out for the high school team. It's growing every year.
Rizzolo says boys lacrosse has been around in the Flathead for about 8 years, but really got organized 3 years ago, which is when the first official state tournament was held.
We have a first-year goalie this year, who is our starting goalie. We've got a bunch of first-year players even at the high school level. Our most senior player has only been playing about 5 years. Our best player on the team, this is only his 4th season playing. He never saw a lacrosse stick until then. So we are working really hard on the youth levels to expand. So that way at the high school level, we're getting kids who've played 5 or 6 years before they even step on the high school field.
Flathead girls lacrosse coach Erin Grieco started up the girls team 3 years ago. She says she has her biggest turnout this year.
23 right now. And 5 of them are youngins, and then the rest are high school girls. But luckily, a lot, 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, and 11th. So I only have 1 senior. So at least I get them for a couple more years.
Grieco grew up playing on the East Coast, took the game to Oregon with her, and as a junior in college, spent a summer working at Glacier Park. She had brought her lacrosse stick with her, but no one else had. She brought it back with her again when she moved to the area post-college.
Well, I wanted somebody to play with.
Grieco says this is part of the reason she started the girls' team in the Flathead.
Having lived in Oregon for 2 years and getting that started on the high school level while U of O was still a club, and now to see them where lacrosse is, you know, second nature in Oregon, that's what just I envision in Flathead, and I think it would be so cool. And then maybe more adults will come and play, and then we can start having club teams for us that used to play.
15-year-old Greta Roberts has been playing all 3 years Grieco's been coaching in the Flathead.
It's unique. I also play hockey, so I like unique sports, just trying something different and being different.
Roberts' brothers played before her, and she was excited to get started when a girls' team came around.
Just I recruited like 4 friends this year, because in the past years we had only like 8 girls. So this year we're really fortunate to have more.
How did you recruit them? Did you have selling points? What did you say?
Just that it's a really fun sport and it's easy to pick up, and you can do it in your backyard.
Most of the teams from across the state do not have school affiliations. Teams in general break down into under 11-year-olds, under 15, and high school aged. Some programs are mixes of all those ages and don't have enough to field full teams. Yet. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
1, 2, 3, Missoula!
Let's go, girls. We got it.
Montana Democrats next month will choose one of 2 candidates who hope to become Montana's next representative in the U.S. House. Republican Congressman Steve Daines is leaving the House to run for the U.S. Senate seat vacated by former Senator Max Baucus and now held by John Walsh. John Lewis and John Driscoll are competing for their party's nomination to advance to November's general election. Editor O'Brien has more on the Democratic House race, featuring 2 men with backgrounds that each says would serve Montanans well.
Neither 36-year-old John Lewis nor 67-year-old John Driscoll has a negative thing to say about the other. The age difference between the two is only raised when directly asked, and even then the answers are cordial. Driscoll, the semi-retired Army National Guard colonel, former Speaker of the Montana House, and former Montana Public Service Commissioner, says Lewis is an impressive young man.
I think he's a pretty sharp young fellow, and I know that I was when I was his age. I'm certain that I was. I was Speaker of the House, and he's apparently done a lot of great things in Washington. It's impressed a lot of people in Washington, so more power to him. I think the only difference there is between myself and him is our age, and probably that I have maybe a wider range of experience in the military and in legislative environment. But he looks like a pretty sharp guy to me.
For his part, Lewis says this primary race isn't about a personal competition with Driscoll. He says it's about the future of Montana and doing what's best for Montanans. The former top aide to then-Senator Max Baucus sees his age as a benefit to voters.
It definitely helps me. I mean, I think I bring a unique perspective as a young father that's thinking about the long, long-term future of our state and our country. And I'm willing to listen and work with both sides and move this country forward, because I think that young folks in this country can see that Congress is not working and it's not thinking about the long-term future. And so that's what I bring to the table, and it's definitely an advantage.
Energy policy is certainly part of any candidate's long-term vision in this increasingly energy-hungry world. Driscoll says domestic energy production is key to America's economic strength and national security. He supports responsible development of our natural resources, such as coal and oil. He also backs development of the Keystone XL pipeline, but predicts it will run into significant political and administrative red tape in Nebraska, so much so that the project may never see the light of day. He says Americans must make our base load electrical plants more efficient than what they are now.
Because what happens when you increase the efficiency, the thermal efficiency of the coal fleet, the curves that contribute to global climate change, they start to flatten real fast. But you need to do it both for the U.S., which is a huge contributor to global climate change, and to the for the Chinese. But instead of putting old burners in or secondhand burners in, put the latest. And that's where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, just like the use of oil for car fuel is dropping off for the first time, that's great. We need to keep conserving, and the same thing with our use of electricity.
While he says fossil fuels are the most cost-effective means of producing energy, he notes more research and development is necessary for renewables. In fact, he says he and his wife invested in solar panels for their home and plan to eventually purchase a plug-in hybrid. John Lewis says energy policy is always a delicate balancing act between creating and preserving jobs while simultaneously ensuring long-term energy supplies.
Energy jobs are a big part of the economy in Montana. For instance, what's going on in the Bakken, fracking has, it's true that fracking has made our economy stronger and helped wean us off oil from unstable regimes, but we also need transparency, too. I think it's reasonable and responsible for people to know what's in fracking fluid. I think that that's common sense. And with coal, there's a lot of jobs affected by that industry, thousands of jobs and families in this state. But we also need to, like I said, think about the future.
Do you believe that the burning of fossil fuels contributes to global climate change?
I do. So that being part of it, our responsibility is let's develop an energy policy that focuses on clean and renewable energy and thinks about the long-term future.
Lewis says he conditionally supports the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, and those conditions include only if the project will support American workers, not decimate property values of farmers and ranchers, and that it be made with best available technologies and materials. He also wants to see a rock-solid emergency response plan in place. On the economy, John Driscoll says the nation's tax system is unnecessarily complicated.
It looks to me like Representative Camp from Michigan, who ran the Ways and Means Committee and had a long series of very serious hearings on how to simplify the tax code. And I think if just having it simple so people will do it will increase revenue because more people will stop hiding from the IRS.
What's the key point? Well, I don't want to go too deep in the weeds, but the key point of this plan that really draws you in?
Well, it's revenue neutral, number one, but basically it reduces the number of tax classes to three.
Is it time, Mr. Driscoll, to raise the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10?
Yeah, my thought was that's not as high as I thought it should be. I think $10.10, that doesn't quite meet my expectations if you take inflation into account. But that's easy for one for me, absolutely.
But how can small businesses that make up the bulk of Montana business, how can they afford that and without passing the cost on to the customers or shutting down altogether?
Well, if they need to be subsidized by the workers, then they got a problem.
John Lewis says there's no question that the nation's tax code needs to be simplified. He points out the mortgage interest deduction must be protected, though, as it benefits so many. Suggestions? You mentioned the mortgage interest. And anything else come to mind that you'd like to see repealed or otherwise?
Well, I think things in there, credits and deductions, I support ones that help our working folks and the middle class. And I'd have to take a look at all the long list of deductions before saying I support or don't support them. But that shows you the challenge faced by those that want to reform the code. And it's a big, big job, but we need to start that conversation and get moving on it.
Is it time, Mr. Lewis, to raise the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10, 10 cents?
Absolutely. Women in this country make 75 cents to the dollar on what men make. In Montana, it's even less. It's about 67 cents. And of all those that make minimum wage in this country, two-thirds of them are women. It's time to raise the minimum wage.
Mm. But how can Montana small business owners make that happen without breaking their backs?
Minimum wage right now is not a living wage. You see it in Montana with, on the worker side of it, many workers working two, even three jobs to make ends meet. So we've got to find a way to balance that out. And also, of course, thinking about our small businesses and Main Street, and that's a challenge. But the current minimum wage, federal minimum wage, is not a living wage.
On gun control, Lewis says his heart goes out to victims of random gun violence.
As a father of small children, I can't even imagine the pain. And my first question with all this would be, what would make someone turn a firearm on innocent people? At the same time, I also believe we need to protect our constitutional rights, which means I support the right of law-abiding citizens to own firearms. And but with that comes an important responsibility. And I believe we need to enforce our current laws to prevent crimes, but also put a heavy focus on improving the way we treat mental health care in this country.
Meaning what?
Why would someone turn a firearm on innocent children? And so I don't know the answer to that question, but I'd like to know. And I think we need to put a focus there. And make sure that the current laws that we have are working. I think we need to fully enforce the laws we have on the books today. If they're not working, then let's take a look at them, and I'm happy to be part of that conversation.
John Driscoll estimates 54% of Montana families have at least 8 guns in the home. By his estimation, probably half are handguns and half rifles.
Well, that's a lot of guns, a lot of tonnage. And so my thinking is we need to start thinking about setting a tonnage limit in Montana. Whatever the tonnage is, and you could arrive at that by a lot of different ways, but whatever that is, that's certainly enough. And from now on, if you're going to buy a gun, you should pay a selective sales tax on it. And the sales tax should be, it can be higher than the 4% general sales tax limited by the Constitution. It could be as high as 100%. Unless you bring in a gun and exchange for it and keep the lid on the tonnage. And so if you want to have more guns, then pay more for them. And I think that I'm a real believer in the effects of price on people. It doesn't impinge on anybody's Second Amendment rights. It just says, okay, enough's enough.
Driscoll says the revenue raised from his tonnage proposal could be used to fund parks or shooting ranges or scholarships. Both men describe themselves as pro-choice candidates who also support gay marriage. John Lewis and John Driscoll are running for the Democratic nomination for Montana's U.S. House seat. The winner will face the winner of the Republican primary race, which features 5 candidates. Montana's primary is June 3rd. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Edward O'Brien.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight, look for partly cloudy skies with isolated rain showers, lows 30s to lower 40s. Wednesday, expect mostly sunny skies, highs in the 70s. In central Montana tonight, look for partly cloudy skies, isolated showers, and thunderstorms in the evening, lows 40s to 45. Wednesday, expect mostly sunny skies, slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon with highs 70 to 75. In southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy. In the evening, then becoming partly cloudy. Scattered rain showers and isolated thunderstorms in the evening, then isolated rain showers after midnight. Lows 35 to 40. Wednesdays, expect increasing clouds, chance of rain showers through the day, chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon, highs 65 to 70. And now for the editorial comments of Dan Gallagher.
This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint. Okay, we've all heard about it, how the VA clinic in Phoenix, by keeping a falsified and delaying appointment list for its patients, may have been responsible for the deaths of 40 or more ailing veterans. Now, surely this is an outrage, and many politicians, citizens, veterans, and veterans organizations are clamoring for a strong response. The most common cry is for the firing of Obama's chief veterans caretaker, Secretary of Veterans Affairs Eric Shinseki. But I have a slightly different take on the whole matter. What I'm seeing surfacing in this debate is political opportunism by many candidates and office holders, as well as a knee-jerk reaction by some who are identified as veterans leaders, who are perhaps exercising their personal political biases or perhaps are filled with what a veteran friend of mine referred to as a bloodlust, seeing the VA as almost as inviting a bureaucratic target as the IRS. Personally, I think that calls for Shinseki's termination are both premature and short-sighted and, in fact, might just be counterproductive. First of all, how would the firing of Shinseki eradicate the clandestine use of and reliance on delayed treatment lists or whatever other rogue actions are hidden in the minds and offices of lower or mid-level VA mismanagers? And do the people screaming for Shinseki's head have a competent replacement in mind, or are they simply willing to find a scapegoat in order to make political hay? And is Shinseki really their target, or could the president be the Isaac they're trying to lay on the sacrificial altar? I give no credibility to and have little regard for candidates or a political party or news networks who have a dismal history of support for the funding of veterans programs but are now talking tough as if, with an election just around the corner, they're the veterans' strike force. With friends like them, veterans have no lack of enemies. This is a time for rational thought and action. Investigate all the charges quickly, seriously, and vigorously before taking a major step such as removing the VA secretary. And now would also be a good time to see some strong, wise political statesmanship on Capitol Hill. Senators John McCain of Arizona and John Tester of Montana are both urging that now would be the time for the deeper problems within the VA to be addressed, rather than finding temporary but immediate catharsis in a few high-profile beheadings, and well, I agree with them. Now, this isn't to say that I necessarily believe Shinseki is the most competent of administrators or that his replacement might not become necessary based on possible culpability. But we don't know that yet. Now, I also believe that the president has to step up to the plate on this, and not simply by tossing out an "I'm mad as hell" comment to band-aid the wound. By the way, let's get real. What happened in Phoenix and elsewhere is unforgivable, but delays of 3 months or more for medical appointments is more the norm than the exception for most veteran patients in the VA system, and it started long before the Phoenix debacle. Well, I myself had to schedule a VA medical appointment recently, and the earliest available date was mid-July. The reality that such delays have come to be seen as commonplace in VA scheduling, that's what should make us all mad as hell. And what is the root cause for these delays? Could it be the lack of funding needed to staff an adequately sized medical component and a lack of treatment options that veterans who are in need can pursue? And gee, I wonder what's behind that condition. By the way, I think it imperative that this very important point be made. I believe that VA medical personnel themselves are, for the most part, the highest quality. The ones I've dealt with are every bit as professional and competent as their private practice counterparts, and maybe even more dedicated to their constituency. The biggest problem is that there just aren't enough of them to do the work being asked of them. And how might that be addressed? Provide adequate funding to hire the medical personnel needed by the veteran population. And I have a couple of other suggestions to offer. Give the VA higher-up officials greater authority in removing incompetent mid- and lower-level VA paper pushers. If there's dead weight, get rid of it. And two, something resembling a voucher system should be liberally implemented in which a qualified veteran seeking medical attention could, if not able to obtain a VA medical spot within, say, 10 days, be able to go instead to a civilian doctor for the needed treatment, with the VA covering the related cost. The current VA crisis could be a chance to make some real progress in veterans' care. Harsh, short-sighted action, although perhaps giving a feeling of retribution, would do no good, maybe even bad. The appearance of taking corrective action, if illusional, would only allow the problem to fester even more. Should Shinseki go? I don't know yet, but now is not that time. Instead, let's focus that energy on treating the real cause, not on putting a bright, shiny, useless Band-Aid on a very real wound. This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint.
Dan Gallagher is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Conrad Scheid.
And I'm Corin Cates-Carney. Thanks for listening, and please join Edwin O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.